Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Gelina. Joining us today is PK Hsu, head of architecture at eMoney Advisors. PK, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on board.
Great to have you. I know when we chatted a month ago about doing this, we figured we'd be in person, but right now it's April of 2020 and we are in the middle of social distancing and quarantine. How's that been?
It's been a little crazy. So the only good thing is I have been working remote mostly anyway, so it's not too much of a change. But still, as everybody knows, having your whole family around is a little bit different now.
Yeah, I think everyone starts off their Zoom call by apologizing for their kids running around.
That's right, exactly.
So you mentioned you've been working remote for a long time. Now it's become even more important. Can you tell us a bit about why you have that philosophy and how it's kind of guided you?
I always believe in remote work. So right now, I have 2.5 teams. I have architecture and data science. And then I'm also running kind of a greenfield project, a new for eMoney, a mobile financial wellness app. And all the members on the team, so they're completely remote, right? Because I really think talent's everywhere. So why am I limiting hiring, let's say, a programmer in Boston? Because I'm in Boston. That seems crazy. So by doing fully remote, I have access to all the talents all around the country, which is a great thing.
So you generally work with all the time zones in the US, like folks kind of spread out?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, does have a little bit of a problem. So like we try to do our stand up in midday East Coast time. The other thing, of course, is when you schedule interviews, right? I mean, I cannot tell you how many times a candidate didn't realize, oh, that's East Coast time and they're 3 hours off. Little things you learn by doing remote for a while.
Yeah, we've done the same thing. We even had a system for a while where we had like an asynchronous video recording system where you could ask interview questions and the candidates would record the responses. And then whenever they were finished recording them, it would then email those responses to people. And then you didn't have to have a phone screen, really. You could just send them the questions.
Really interesting. I might steal that idea.
Well, we developed it as a product. It didn't sell very well. Like everyone's like, oh, that's kind of a cool idea, but it's more of a feature than a product per se.
Yeah, maybe.
But there is a company called HireVue. I don't know if they're still around, but they were doing that and seemed to be pretty successful with it.
Very interesting.
So are there any other tools or techniques or secrets that you have for making remote work, especially across time zones? Do you try to do video and face-to-face whenever possible? Do you have other things that you do as a matter of practice?
Yeah, there are a few things, right? If you just look at a team that is completely remote, things are certainly easier because the team expects to be working with each other remotely. So that helps a lot. We definitely do a lot of video calls and everybody's getting very good at A, handling the mic, and more importantly, figuring out how the mute buttons work. With this whole new work from home, how many times we have people not understanding what the mute button does or when to hit it or whether it is muted or not. And that kind of stuff, I think people learn very, very quickly.
Yeah, the click clacking of a keyboard.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm sure you do the same thing, right? We were so good at it that we can troubleshoot people's connections. Oh, I think you have the wrong mic. Yeah. Try that. Click here. Switch your headphones, right? So all those are part of the remote culture, I think.
Now, way back in the day, I think you had a first foray into remote work working with a graphic designer, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is maybe 12 years ago now. I was running my own small consulting company. So we're doing custom web application and I just needed a web designer. So I found this person. So Corey, shout out to Corey. Maybe through something that she wrote online, I reached out and said, hey, look, I'm looking for a designer. Do you mind first designing a logo for me and go from there? And next thing you know, maybe 4 or 5 years since then, she has been our remote designer. I have never met her in person. I have never even heard her voice because all the work is done email or chatting, text chatting online. And I only know kind of know what she looks like because she draws comic strips of her family sometimes. So I kind of know the comic book version of her and that's it. And it works really well.
In fact, one of our first big forays was graphic design. In 2003, started Syrinx, started growing the company, and hey, we need a logo. Hey, we need some of the basics done. And a friend of mine from Indianapolis introduced me to a guy from Georgia. Shout out to Sean Schoff, also known as Sean Rocks. Sean, we did some phone calls, shipped some artifacts back and forth, and he came up with the Syrinx logo, gave us an EPS and an AI and JPEG and all that stuff. still use it to this day. I just emailed that to a sign vendor the other day in order to get something.
That is a great story.
So we've worked with Sean on and off since then for, gosh, 2003 to 20, 17 years. I've known him ever since. We've worked on some projects for end clients together. He's done some more internal Syrinx stuff. But yeah, never met him in person, but it's worked very well. I think graphic design in particular tends to be very gig oriented. You know, a lot of the, even the development projects we do, it's, you know, maybe there's some mock-ups in the beginning. Then there's the chop where they're like making little elements out of it that we can then weave into HTML and CSS and so forth to actually make a web app. And that's kind of a pretty well-defined project. What do you guys do for graphics in your apps?
So we have, for this app in particular, we have internal designers. So that's way easier now that we have the resources and so forth. But you're right. I think people really should embrace the remote culture. That has to be the way of the future, right? I mean, the whole digital nomad concept, I think, is very popular now. You know, why shouldn't I live in, if I'm a skier, I guess, live in the north, but I still want to do fintech work and that the company may be based in New York.
Yeah, Ben Seckley, who was recently a guest on Underserved, talked about how when his company was getting together, all of the founders were like, you know what, we don't have to be in the office right now. So like one was in Australia, he was out west skiing and he would ski and then come home and write code, do whatever, and then repeat. And they got the company bootstrapped completely virtually.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly take advantage of this, right? And I certainly encourage my team to do so as well. The fact that you're at home, there's zero commute, right? My commute is going downstairs. You can mix your personal life, your family life, and your work life a little bit better. I don't feel bad if I have to, you know, take half an hour and drop my kid off at soccer or whatever. It's just more flexible that way. And I think the quality of life goes up, the quality of the work goes up. So it's a win-win, really.
I think you mentioned that one of the things you do with that recaptured commute time is that you're able to teach a programming class to kids.
Yeah, so I love edtech. I love education, so hence I love edtech, and fintech and edtech are the two things I'm really, really interested in and passionate about. So I have been on and off teaching a programming class at the local library for middle schoolers because I think it's very important for kids to understand just problem solving and computational thinking. Not that they necessarily want to grow up as a programmer, but being able to troubleshoot, problem solve, think systematically, I think it's a very, very important skill.
I think even just realizing how systems work, that it's not a black box.
That's right.
When we hire folks at Syrinx, you know, we hire obviously a lot of software engineers, developers, QA folks, and so on, but we also hire salespeople and recruiters, and they may not have a big technical background. Maybe they didn't take programming courses before. And so usually the first thing we do is sit them down and have a session with me where I explain, this is code, this is a compiler, this is an executable, this is how things run, this is a three-tiered system, this is a two-tiered system, this is horizontal scalability, and this is JSON, and this is asynchronous Java, and this is how Google Maps works under the covers. And you can see their eyes light up like, oh, that's how that works. Oh, that's why that gets slow when there's a lot of people on the network, and it really clicks for them. So I think another thing you're trying to plan is a robotics workshop for the kids.
So what we are planning to do after school finishes is to do a short one-week summer camp where we use Lego robotics bricks and motors to build robots. I think robot is really, really cool for kids, right? So it's a very, very good way to get them into unknowingly learning how to program.
That's cool. Now, I think you're also into audio and become a bit of an audiophile. How did that all start?
I think being an engineer, you're always interested in gear, right? And sound system is always a fun thing. These days, though, I'm more interested in headphones and to some extent microphones because we do a lot of video calls, as you said, working remotely. So I do have a collection of headphones that I'm too embarrassed to tell you how large and how much money I invested in it, but it's fun.
Yeah, I have what they call GAS, gear acquisition syndrome.
Oh, I love that. That's right.
Well, I ended up buying a bunch of gear when I was trying to figure out podcasting. I too was curious because I'd been on a zillion WebExes and why does it sound so terrible with my computer mic? And well, it sounds a little bit better if I call in. What is the difference? And is there any way I can get this computer audio better? And I started looking into how do people actually record? And I'll give the 2-minute cheat sheet for anyone.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Wants to sound better on a WebEx. So any halfway decent mic is okay. You don't need a $400 mic. You don't need a $1,000 mic. I'd say the base tier is if you can at least get headphones with a boom arm, that's going to sound okay. If you can wear headphones and have a separate mic, like PK is doing that right now with a Blue Yeti condenser mic, which is a very popular USB mic. I'm actually talking into an Audio-Technica mic that can either do USB or it has an XLR output coming out of it, which is like a little three-pinned audio cable that's a standard in the industry. The way I make this relatively cheap mic sound very good is running it through a preamp. If you picture what's going on with a microphone, there's a tiny little super skinny ribbon. And when I speak and the air vibrates, it makes that ribbon vibrate, makes the tiniest of little currents. I mean, it's like trying to start a fire with a spark. And the thing that turns that spark into a flame is some sort of amplification that's very clean. Here at home, I have a Cloud Lifter, which is somewhat expensive preamp, but they make cheaper ones. Other companies, I think there's one called Dynamite, and I'll look up the other one, put it in the show notes. There's another inline one you can get. And the preamp then takes the signal from the mic and makes it much louder. So then the amp inside your computer audio interface, in this case, I'm using one from Shure, but there's a bunch of inexpensive ones available. Just makes that signal going in there so much cleaner that the Shure doesn't have to do that much work. And you get a lot of what's called signal to noise. You get very good amount of audio signal and very little background noise or just ambient room noise with it. So definitely you cannot do the old use my internal microphone, use my internal speakers. That's every bad conference call you've ever been on where there's like an echo and everyone has to mute. So at least start with the headphones and a separate mic, either a boom arm on the headphones or one on the desk. And then if you can get an inexpensive preamp before it goes in your computer, even better. The USBs are okay. I had a hard time getting them to sound right. And that's why I use the XLR with a preamp.
All right, so that is definitely a pro level gear there, right? But I mean, talking about mics when people do conference again, right? There are a noticeable difference between a really good boom mic that has active noise canceling at the mic level than not, right? So the headset I use, I can literally be sitting in front and watching a TV show and people on the other end wouldn't know that the TV is on, which is important when your family is running around, your kids are running around and banging around, right? So I think little things like that is certainly investment, but it's worth it. And people speak through either the computer or even the little wire mic that they have. I mean, that's just not a good idea.
Yeah, AirPods don't work that well. Wired earpods don't work that well, especially if the little mic is scratching against your clothing while you're trying to talk into them.
Yeah, that's it. Good. Exactly.
Which headset do you use?
So a couple of them. And for the mic, I think the Plantronics Voyager, maybe. That one's having the best mic. I'm sure there are other ones that are as good out there, but that's the one that I like a lot. The battery lasts a long time, which is the important thing.
Yeah, Plantronics is very good. They came up making headsets for people that are on the phone all day long, like salespeople and customer support people. And their gear is very good. I've had good luck with Sennheiser as well. The audio company, they make a headset that if it's not currently a pandemic is only $40.
Wow.
Right now, if you try to buy it, it's $140.
Right. Isn't it crazy? Right.
You can't find them anywhere. Sennheiser makes one that's not like over the ear. It's like two earphones and then a boom mic, and it is active noise canceling. USB, just plug it in. It works on Mac, PC. It's about $40 on Amazon normally.
That sounds good. You have done this too, right? You know, when I was using my Apple AirPods, because the battery runs up so fast and I'm on the call maybe 5 hours a day. So I got to do that, put the left ear one in, charge the right ear and swap. I mean, it was just crazy trying to do that.
Yeah, it's a pain. And then if you have an Apple device, when you take one out, it tries to pause things. And
That's right.
To find my next job, first, I want to hear about dozens of jobs I am overqualified for.
Someday, I will talk to a recruiter who knows the difference between Java and JavaScript. That will be the one.
Would I mind commuting 3 hours each way each day? Of course not.
All I have to do is go through 5 separate interviews, complete a 10-hour coding exercise, and recite the national anthem backwards? I'm in.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Xerox Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
All right, so when you were talking about kids and programming languages, I think you had been involved with Scratch. Can you tell folks who don't know what it is, what it's about, and why it's a great fit for teaching kids?
Oh, absolutely. So Scratch was invented at the Media Lab, the Lifelong Kindergarten part of the Media Lab. And what it is at its core, is a graphical programming environment where I would say a second grader for sure can start using by herself. But we have tried it with kindergartners if you just give them a little bit of help. And what it is a system where it has very low floor, which means you can get started really quickly. It has a very high ceiling, which means you can do like amazingly complex things with it. I've seen people who develop Minecraft-like environment within Scratch, which is kind of crazy, right? But if you follow the literature, right, they will say it is not just low floor and high ceiling, which is important. It also has very, very wide walls, which means horizontally, you can use it to do many, many different things. That's my point about not everybody wants to be a programmer. And I'm also very big on women in computing, gender equality, right? So people say, oh, you know, programming stuff is programming games, about fighting games, and it's all about boys doing boys things. That's absolutely not true. The fact that Scratch has a very wide wall is you can use it to do all kinds of stuff. If you go on the website, some of the more popular stuff are, I guess you would call it webisodes. So these are TV shows that a group of people work together to produce. They have great storyline. Good animation for sure, but it's all about content, right? It's basically just a great TV show. And things like that, I think you would not find anywhere else.
Yeah, I've seen kids use Scratch to make games, but I think you told me about one girl you were working with made this cool little animation to explain how our parents met.
Yeah, so this is one of the stories that I always tell when people ask me, is Scratch just for games, right? It is not. So a while ago, I was teaching this class. I think this student must be in the fourth grade. And she animated this little story about how her parents met. I think her parents were from two different parts of the world. And it is honestly the cutest story ever, right? So there's nothing about games. It is just good content. And she managed to do that very quickly, maybe within 2 weeks of after school session. So maybe 2 or 3 hours. And the result is just wonderful. Now, there are people who've done amazing games as well. So don't get me wrong, but you can use it for many, many different things.
Yeah, I like the intersection of art and storytelling with technology. I think it's very interesting. We did a fairly simple thing at the office, but it came out really cool. We had some old monitors lying around, and I took a Raspberry Pi and hooked them up to each of them. And then we recorded just some short, maybe 5 to 7 second things where like one of the folks in the office would like walk in, smile, walk out, left to right, right to left, up, down, pop up like a woodchuck or gopher or whatever, go down off the bottom of the screen, do some sort of signature move. One of the guys, Mike, we shot a thing where it looks like he's upside down hanging like Spider-Man, but we'd actually shot it right side up and then flipped it over. So we made all these cool little mini animations, loaded them on the Pis, and there's this thing called MP4 Museum. Some guy in Europe made this Pi image that's just got a little Python script on it, and you plug in a USB stick and whatever video files are on there, it'll play them. And I just hacked the script so it would play them in a random order. And with all four monitors playing the clips in random orders all the time, it sometimes looks like the people are interacting in between the two monitors just because of chance, but it's pretty cool. And when you come up to the office, when times are more normal, I'll have to show you.
Oh, I love to see it, right? Again, so that at the heart really is an art project, right? It's a digital art. And whoever's created it needs to know programming. So again, it's the point that programming is just a skill. It's nothing to do with taking a job in the computer industry. But if you're an artist today, digital art, interactive art is pretty much the norm here.
I think you said there was another story about a kid that built like a giant world in Scratch that lets you explore.
Yeah, so this is the wide wall parts again, right? Like you can just Scratch to build anything you want. So this kid, again, back then, probably in the fourth grade, he basically just starting to put rooms after rooms, cities after cities together as little scenes and link them together. So it becomes an open-ended adventure world. It's almost like one of these bigger multiplayer games, right? But he was certainly too young to even realize that that stuff exists, but he basically created it himself because why not?
Yeah, I think you got to go after like, what are the kids interested now? I think you mentioned there was a bottle flipping.
Do you remember those bottle flipping? So when I teach a class, I'm always trying to figure out, okay, what is the current hot things? For a while, it was bottle flipping. So we said, hey, you know, why don't we just create bottle flipping in Scratch? And that was a hit at that time. And I don't know what is the hot thing. These days, the hot things will be online learning, getting stuck at home. So maybe we'll use that as a topic next time when we run a class.
Well, my youngest daughter has discovered Fortnite and has got like a little band of kids from her school, and they all go in there marauding or whatever. And now she started doing solos. And the other day she actually won like 100-person melee or whatever and sent me a picture. And I'm like, oh, honey, daddy's so proud. How many kills did you have?
That's right. But interesting, right? Like, actually, you just reminded me, going back to working remotely, right? The company culture as a whole is important. You know, it's pretty normal for a company to say, hey, look, we're going to bring lunch in and everybody do whatever. Well, if you have a remote team, how do you do it? Like, how do you socialize remotely? And I don't know the answer. So at one point I thought, huh, maybe, you know, everybody should just get onto Fortnite and hang out playing Fortnite, except that not everybody wants to do Fortnite. So I don't know what is the remote virtual equivalent of a ice cream party or something.
I actually have two suggestions for you that have happened to me in the last few weeks. One, I noticed a partner company of ours dropped something on my calendar one day. And although I didn't attend it, I immediately grabbed onto the idea. It was a virtual happy hour. And so then I said for folks at Syrinx, hey, you know, since we don't see each other that often and even video calling, we maybe only do a couple wide scale things that aren't point to point per week. How about Friday at 3 p.m.? Everyone grab your favorite drink, adult or soft drink, crack it open, get on our Skype. The Skype call will go off exactly at 3 o'clock. If you can join, great. If you can't, that's okay. Try to join video if you can and just talk about what's going on. Sometimes we'll talk about work stuff. Sometimes we'll talk about home stuff. Sometimes someone will end up giving us a virtual home tour with their iPhone or whatever. That ended up being great. Now we're doing that every week. And then another guy I know used to have a poker party at his house. You know, like every month he'd have people over and play No Limit Hold'em, like a tournament game or something like that. And can't have everyone over now. So he found software called Poker Maven, where you can actually host this online, either on Amazon or your own server, and you can have people on there. And then you could have a Zoom room or 8x8 or whatever going in parallel. And everyone could still talk and kibitz and whatever while they were playing poker together, just as though they were in person.
Great. So you're not getting me into trouble in promoting poker at work, right?
That's optional. But the virtual happy hour, you could totally do.
Yeah, so shout out to somebody that I work with, Stephanie. So she actually started that for one of the teams. So, but I still find like it's not the same, right? So there are some things that are not the same. So occupying the same physical space, eating, drinking, chit-chatting is still different than doing it remotely. So I hope somebody can figure out something that is equally as fun or as relaxing.
Well, some folks are saying that this may be a long-term game changer for commercial real estate because some commercial clients may say, do we really need this much footprint? Maybe we should have more people working remote. Maybe we should have a smaller office footprint that we pay per square foot per month every month. And I, on the other hand, there's certain things that having a physical office that everyone comes to and has interactions. And like you said, you break bread and you have the informal things. There's something to be said for that, or at least having the option of doing it every once in a while. So I don't know which way it's going to head.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when I started this other project, right, entire team is remote. And I really thought we could do everything remote 100% of the time. And it turned out that we got together as a team once or twice, and that make a huge difference. So I'm convinced, like you said, quarterly get together, it's certainly worthwhile doing. And, you know, maybe we take the budget from office space and use it for travel.
Yeah, I think front end loading too. Like I know when we've done remote projects for clients, if we do have some FaceTime up front, you meet, shake hands, if that's still safe to do, you know, talk with one another, kind of go over things, get buy-in, agree to things, and then go off and do it and maybe check in now virtually by con calls or WebEx or whatever. That's better than going pure virtual from the start. At least that's been our experience with project work.
Yeah, I agree.
So I also saw a blog post from you, Lessons from a Slimy CEO. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So as a parent, right, you're always trying to nudge the kids to learn things, and sometimes it's hard. So one of the things was spreadsheeting, basically Excel. Amazingly, 2020, it's still a very important tool. But how do you get a middle schooler to do that, right? Like, it's just the most boring things in the world. But my daughter was jumping onto slime, if you remember the slime-making bandwagon, and they had a little business going and, you know, bought supplies and said, hey, you know, that's an easy way to track your orders and track your expenses. Just open this little thing and start typing. So it's a very, very subtle way to get her to understand the power of spreadsheeting. And then she has a purpose because she actually wants to figure out, was she making money from this or not?
Was that the aha moment, like sales minus expenses?
I think it's that, and also the fact that you can externalize it. From a business point of view, right, it is very important to understand you can model it, you can write it down, you can have it come up to be some exact number to the cent. Right? Business is a lot more than just an idea.
Yeah, I've been trying to get my kids somewhat interested in Excel. I'll admit that I didn't touch, I think we were doing spreadsheets finally in college. Once I did my co-op during college, I got really exposed. So I was working with a manufacturing company to help them track data and variance on manufacturing saw blades.
That sounds really, really exciting.
While the data gathering and stuff wasn't that much fun, and there was a lot of like rekeying stuff into Excel from sheets that folks had filled out on the shop floor, then building the formulas in order to figure out how close are they doing, are they out of tolerance, like how long is it taking to make things on average, even just getting exposed to like sum and average and so forth was pretty cool. And then at the time, I was also delivering pizza for Domino's, and I would track my tips. Every night I would come home, put in my tips, my mileage, how many deliveries I did, and figure out on average, like what was a good tip and what was an average tip.
So were you doing things like modeling and trying to figure out which neighborhood is the best and stuff like that?
You could do that by your head. You know, you remember certain addresses. You'd be like, oh, 549 Russell Road, that's not going to be great. Whereas like 80 Highland Drive, oh, that guy always tips well. But you would start realizing nights and times, and not so surprisingly, Friday and Saturday night between 4 and 9 was usually the best. But yeah, you would start figuring out, all right, how do I kind of optimize my shifts? Can I make sure I'm scheduled for those hours? Maybe I volunteer to work some of the crappy hours before or after in order to get that good shift.
Right, totally. Right. This is basically data-driven decision-making, right? You are validating perhaps your intuition, and hopefully your intuition was right, but it may not be, right? You may realize that, hey, for some strange reason, Saturday at 3 p.m. is a hot time. I don't know. But with real data collected and analyzed, I think you get to a much clearer picture.
I think you said your son was exercising and getting a bit into tracking his gym usage in a spreadsheet.
Yeah, just in general. So I am a little bit of a quantify self person. Although I talk a good game, I wouldn't say I do it well. And I think I basically got my kids into it a little bit as well. So he's certainly a lot more organized than your average high schooler, you know, tracking different things. Again, externalizing live events, right? So record it so that you can look at it.
Now, I think there's a not so well-known trivia fact that you're also a contributor on Perfect Pack.
All right. So this is something that very few people know. And it is a fun thing. One of my side hobbies is I write for this website called The Perfect Pack. And what it is a community and a website that basically carrying solutions with backpacks, messenger bags, and everything in between. And it's really fun. And I'm talking about backpacks that you probably wouldn't know the brand. It's not something that you can go buy at Staples. They are usually designed by a person and either made by himself or herself, or they have a small warehouse somewhere. Most of them are obviously US-based businesses because I'm in the US. And it's great fun. It ticks many boxes for me.
Now, is that to optimize your business travel or what got you interested?
It's a little bit of both. I think as an engineer, I really appreciate good intentional design. And what these bag makers do is that, right? They have a problem to solve. It could be, oh, how do I carry enough load and go long distance and being comfortable? Or how do I design the smallest pack that has good organization that I can take on a run? So seeing how they solve the problem is fun. Being a small community, I also get to interact with these makers a lot. So sometimes they would crowdsource. They would say, hey, look, guys, I'm designing a new backpack. I have these ideas. What do you guys think? And everybody chit-chat away. And how cool is it that you see, oh, he took my idea and put it in the product. So I think that's fun. But for work, for sure, not right now, but I travel quite a bit. And it is important to figure out how to do one bag travel, right? Put everything you need with you, all the gear, and run down Logan Airport without feeling too tired or dropping things. So all of that goes back to the whole finding the perfect bag situation.
Now, I looked on the site and it seemed like there was also a crossover. Some folks from like the military or law enforcement seemed really into it as well.
Yeah, it's the funniest thing. So quite a few of us basically are tech workers or mobile workers. That's something we carry on our laptops. But if you think about pack designs, right, a lot of this came from the military world, where a well-designed pack, literally, I think it's a matter of life and death. So there is huge overlap with law enforcement, a huge overlap with military or ex-military person. So it's funny, if you look at my social media feed, I sometimes see things that I normally wouldn't see. I mean, there would be gun shows and whatever on my feed because I happen to share some interest with that crowd.
With the backpack guy.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, PK, thank you very much for taking the time and setting up the gear to record remotely with us. We appreciate you being on the show.
Andrew, this is really fun. I always wanted to do a podcast, so you just check something off my bucket list.
Glad we could do it. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon and talking to everyone again soon on the next episode of Underserved.